lean over and shout at it.
We'll be all right.
Now we are recording, are we? I become anxious. Right. And we were talking about gluten, well, starch, and then discussion about gluten began during the power outage. And you were talking about different grades of gluten.
Yes, there was a 75% and an 80%, which is standard in the industry. And the 80% gluten, just the plain 80% gluten, was used in baking applications, but it was also used in Kellogg's cereal. What is that cereal? The one that they want dieting women to eat.
Special K.
That's it. And that went
so
to
that's
London.
That's got added gluten.
Yeah,
right?
And yes. And that went to London, Ontario. But that plant closed too.
Yes. And one wonders, let me hold that question for a little bit. And you were saying something as well in the break about Shaw Bakeries.
Yes, Shaw Bakeries used to purchase gluten for their baking process as well. I'm not sure which products they used it in, but most large bakeries would use it. Certainly our biggest customers were the big industrial bakers in the States.
Yeah. And you mentioned the sort of industrial process, added industrial, in which a chemical was added to some of the gluten to make it.
Well, no, but that was still a food product, and yes, that made the gluten, whatever wonderful qualities gluten had, this magnified them.
Mm-hmm.
And that.
And you think it was ascorbic acid that
yes,
was being added.
And Ogilvy held a patent on that.
Yeah. There's a certain amount of R&D research work being done by Ogilvy in Montreal.
Lots of it. At one point, there was a lot of it for the flour side had their baking applications and the food applications, and then there was a whole industrial side. The ADM ended up shutting that down too, but.
Well, before we pursue this matter of the change in ownership and control and all of its ramifications, let me ask you about the workforce. How many people worked in the mill and in the various areas of it?
Well,
based perhaps on your experience in the later mid-90s when you rose to the top for a time.
The workforce was steadily being cut back, yes, just like every other industry, and each production shift had one operator per process stream,
and you ran around the clock.
Ran around the clock.
So it's a process industry.
Yeah, 24/7. We used to shut down once a month or so to clean, and we'd shut down for a couple of days at Christmas. And otherwise, it just went all the time.
Yes.
It had to, because it was too much work to clean, and too much waste.
Yes.
There was a lot of waste.
So you were saying there was one operator on each of the processes.
Right, and then during the day, the warehouse operation was in place, and the packaging operation took place on two shifts. So, you know, you had fellas working in the plant, and at one point, Ogilvy was one of those places where young men went to work after they finished high school.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of people used to work there at some point. And so,
I wonder if the Board of Education has ever given thought to the fact that the high school graduates weren't able to find work any longer. Do their guidance departments focus the fact that one needs more now with the industrial grain products gone and so many other plants?
All the other sort of processing plants, places where you actually make something,
yes,
as opposed to providing some sort of a service.
Right.
Those things.
What would the total workforce have been, let's say, around 1990 to
Well, I'm just trying to think now when the plant closed. I think there were 75 or 76, but we had some people who were on disability and whatnot. I think there were 66 or 67 active people in the plant and in the office.
That was the least you could have to operate it by that time, I suppose.
Pretty much.
Reductions
right.
have taken place.
Yeah. Pretty much.
How much of the change that's taken place at there and in other plants was the result of the free trade agreement and NAFTA? Did you sense the impact of continentalization of our
economy? No, I can't say that I did, because there were so few wheat gluten plants and wheat starch and gluten plants that I don't think it was one of those things. I think the biggest thing for us was the Crow's Nest Palace.
The loss of the the subsidy
for the preferential rate, yeah.
Right, the increase in cost of the wheat movement.
Yeah, I think that was it. Mind you, as Ogilvy, as ADM was closing this plant, about 2 or 3 weeks after it was announced that Brian Mulroney was going to be on the board at ADM.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a sweet moment for us all.
Well, it's when there was a time when Canada depended on foreign investment. I think that's still a residual thing out there in the Canadian public. Americans brought their money, their technology, and so on. And because of the tariffs that existed, Canadian industrialization was to some extent derivative from the American. Now, there were certainly exceptions to that, although I wouldn't want to have to come up with many examples immediately, but once, and the economists talked in the 70s and 80s, I was reading economics to some extent as well as my basic history, and they talk about the miniature replica effect, which is to say that in Canada we had branch plants that really mimicked American plants designed to provide for the Canadian market. And once
that wasn't the case with ours, because we weren't American to start out with.
Established.
We were
by Ogilvy.
Yeah, there were two Canadian plants, and the Canadian plants, the Canadian Ogilvy, ended up buying an American plant.
Mm-hmm. When did they do that? Do you remember roughly?
You know, I would say that might have been in the mid '80s.
Mm-hmm.
The plant in Iowa, it was a Henkel plant, I think, and then Labatt's. When did Labatt's bought Ogilvy in 1968.
That early.
And
why did they buy Labatt? What did they get?
You know,
from Labatt?
I don't know, but what they did get was a lot of cash. And when they needed cash to, after the American peso tanked, is when they sold their jewel in the crown, the papers called it, which was Ogilvy, cash. It was mm-hmm. about cash. So I think that had that not happened, because Labatt's was expanding into Mexico, and then the peso tanked, and they needed cash to pay for all their acquisitions down there, and they sold it, mm-hmm. and that's when big companies like ADM can swoop in and ADM wanted the flour mills, mm-hmm. no interest in the gluten. Because before that point, we even used to make gluten that was packaged for ADM.
So they knew the plant and the product.
Well, they knew the product. It was one of the products that they sell. They still have the two starch and gluten plants, as far as I was able to determine, because it's hard to get a lot of information about ADM. But mm-hmm. So they still have that part of the business, but it's tiny compared to the other stuff.
And that's a real difficulty in these companies as they become bigger and bigger. The specialized operations.
You probably don't make it through a day without eating something that's been touched or owned by ADM
mm-hmm.
or one of the big agri processors.
And yet it's a family owned, or more or less, no?
No, Cargill is family owned.
Okay. Because how many sisters, let's say in the oil industry, the one gets, let's talk about Seven Sisters, but there are a limited number of companies in the U.S. that dominate the grain trade.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. And But ADM is very much a public company, and they're so big, and certainly there's a bit of a family flavor to it, but I don't think it was ever a family company, but I'm not sure. And they, because they're so big, they can attract, you know, people like Brian Mulroney.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that are on their board, it's a who's who, it, really.
I wonder how much practical advice they get. Well, better not being there, one shouldn't ask questions about it. How large was the office?
Oh, the office is still there. Now, I tried to find some more out about that, about the office, because the office was part of the original Ogilvie Flour Mill. And the front of it, that does, I mean, it doesn't face the tracks. When if you're driving down Syndicate Avenue, you look, you can see the building, and that's the back of the building. But the front of it was like almost like a storefront. And
it faces the river?
And at one point, the mill manager lived there,
oh, really?
I think. There were gardens, there was a gardener, all that stuff. I never saw that, but I heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very old building.
Heritage building, if we chose.
Well, I mean, I don't, but it's old. The basement, called the catacombs. So the office was not so much, it was created out of what was there before, because the mill manager lived upstairs. So the upstairs had a kitchen, kitchen, bathroom,
was
with a bathtub.
Quite well appointed. Would a manager be happy to live there?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. It was very nice. I had a wonderful office. The plant manager's office was fantastic. I used to call it the Oval Office. It had a fireplace in one end, and mind you, it wasn't working anymore, but it was spectacular. And I think that was the living room or your parlor or whatever they called it. And so all the commercial stuff would then happen downstairs. Mm-hmm. And by the time the plant closed, the microbiology lab had been moved over to the office building. There used to be a little bit of research and tinkering that got done there by some of the technical salespeople. And there were four office staff. Mm-hmm. Myself, there was sort of an office manager, logistics guy, and then two other gals.
Secretaries, administrative
assistants. Well, yeah, administrative, and then there was an inventory clerk, and so it wasn't.
And all of that had been computerized by the 90s, so it probably didn't require as many people as it had at an earlier time, or not.
Well, it was still. The systems for tracking the inventory were computerized, but you still had to, you know, the computer picked what was going to go out the door, first in, first out. And I guess there was one less person required. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there didn't, you know, you still had all your accounts payable. We mm-hmm. never did receivables, just payables. And then once ADM came on the scene, we didn't even do payables, just get them ready and send them off.
Because the money flowed to Montreal, so that's why the receivables went out of the Montreal office.
Yeah, ADM was pretty good about controlling their money. They controlled the money out of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And they had lots of it, and they knew how to manage it.
Every time I receive a service and I'm not billed for a month or more, I say to myself, someone's got more working capital than I thought they had.
Well, ADM has an incredible amount of working capital.
Yeah, but they keep the money flowing in as quickly as they can.
I'm not sure how it is now, but back then it was a very flat management system.
Mm-hmm.
I reported to a VP. And
not much in the way of middle management.
No. There was a plant manager, and then you're talking pretty much to a VP
through to 97.
And so that if you wanted money or needed money, there was no budgeting. Spend as little as you have to in less than last month. And someone down there would be looking at it, and they had so many operations that they would, you know, they'd be looking at, you know, they'd be looking at their ratios and saying, hey, something's wrong here, what's, you know, whatever. And there were a lot of questions. They certainly knew their business. Mm-hmm. They knew their businesses.
Did they come up here?
Sure. Yeah. Mind you, there was a Canadian VP, and a lot of that, they didn't believe in traveling for travel's sake either.
No.
So, and the people that traveled were the VPs, and they had their little Learjet, and off they went. But there was more traveling when it was Ogilvy. Mm-hmm. You know, so the two operations were so completely different.
Much leaner in the case of the ADM.
Yeah, much leaner.
Yeah. The lab in which you worked, how large was that? And what kinds of skills were to be found? And the people with degrees were primarily in the lab, I guess, were they?
Yes. And that is something that happened pretty much when I started working there. Because, you know, it was someplace that people would work for a little bit because we didn't get paid very well. And so guys would stay there for a little bit until they moved on to something else. There weren't very many people who actually, many men who made their career there. And then once they were able to get people with degrees and more education.
Were you the first one?
Besides the lab manager, yeah.
Yeah. As you were saying, once they were able to, they had to pay more.
Well, they didn't for a long time. We did have a plant manager who was very sympathetic to our skills versus our compensation. So that
he knew the bargain he was getting, but he was a little uneasy about that.
Well, he was a really good guy, you know, and figured we should get paid more, and so he.
Who was this fine person?
Norm Pullman.
Norm Pullman.
Yeah, right. And then. And we had a good bunch there, and all of them had degrees because you could. I mean, there were all kinds of people walking around with those science degrees that they could find other work with in Thunder Bay.
This was an area in which there was not much competition for Ogilvy.
No, and it was really hard to find a job. And you know, back then, even the Ministry of the Environment had a beautiful lab, so that was some place where people could go to work, and that's gone too. Right. Mm-hmm. So it became really tough for anybody technical, if you were technical, and it wasn't a hospital. Where were you going to work?
Yeah. How many people did work there at any one time? How many people were required to?
Well, when I started,
keep the place
there were over 100.
In the lab?
No.
Oh, this is the whole plant.
In the lab. When I started, there were four... what we call process technicians, because we were working around the clock.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple...
One for each shift and one other person? Well, two during the day?
It takes four people, four shifts, to cover a 24-hour operation. At four shifts, like four different people.
Yes.
Just the mathematics of it. And so there were four people that did that. And usually you'd have a shift and whatever. There were, you know, a couple of other technicians. There was, so that's four, plus a couple of others, that's six. There's a microbiologist, seven, a manager, eight, and one other guy, you know, eight or nine.
Mm-hmm. Almost a tenth of the 100 you were stating as a quant.
Yeah, and so, and then over the years, there was no night shift. We quit the night shift because we found...
In the lab.
Mm-hmm, because there was an instrument that would measure protein.
And was this an addition to the process that displaced a person then, or had the instrumentation been there earlier?
No, this was a new instrument that was purchased in the lab to test finished product.
Mm-hmm.
And the operators used it to monitor their process. So once, and the lab would, we would still do proteins from scratch with wet chemistry, to check the calibration of the instruments. But
first thing in the morning, I suppose.
And after that was done, then the operators could go ahead and use the instrument through the night. So that eliminated one shift.
Yes.
So,
those.
Yeah. Okay. okay. We were talking about.
Yes. What were we talking about?
We were talking about the number of people in the lab, right, and yes, then the
and the process. The,
yeah. The
no need for a night shift. To,
once and the grain elevators and the grain commission were using the same instrument. Mind you, their needs were a little bit different than ours, but basically the same thing, you know, measuring protein.
Yes.
Because that's the big thing with the grain, moisture and protein, and so this instrument would measure moisture and protein. And
yes.
So.
The was the employee group or the workforce one for bargaining purposes? I'm thinking now about unionization. Was it already unionized when you?
Oh yes, there were there were two unions there.
Okay.
There.
One in the office, I suppose.
The no. The there was the TCU and whatever previous whatever it was called before.
Lodge 650, the grain handlers.
It wasn't that. It was its own lodge number. The Brotherhood of Railway Workers.
Clerks,
whatever. And then,
BRAC.
And then it that became TCU.
Yes,
right?
Transportation Communications Union.
So that was the union that that represented the people in the production workers.
Yeah.
And then we had a boiler, and we had pipe fitters, and they were all with the IUOE.
International Union of Operating Engineers, right?
Yeah. So okay. there were the two unions.
And so you saw Frank Mazur as well, I guess. Did you then?
I never met Frank Mazur, but I knew Herbie quite well. Herbie Danner.
Yeah. So was Herbie the one?
Well, when we were negotiating,
leading you, advising you, or whatever, rather than Frank. Frank was definitely in charge of Lodge 650 through the early 80s.
Well, the thing is, I didn't get involved with any of the negotiating until sort of later.
When you were on the other side of the table?
By
that time or earlier?
Well, I was. The lab wasn't unionized.
Was not.
No, hence they didn't pay us. They didn't have to.
And Brack never thought of organizing the lab.
I'm not sure why they didn't bring
us. If the union was plant wide.
But if you listen to the what's that word? Not a rumor.
Urban legend.
Yes. the company found ways to rid themselves of people who were interested in getting unionized.
Except that they'd had to accept one for the bulk of the workers.
Oh, yeah, that was one thing. But unionizing the lab was quite another.
So anyone who made a move in that direction, you sensed would be let go.
Yes. And I didn't ever witness that myself.
No.
But I heard about it.
And you never tested it.
No. especially once they started paying us a bit more and whatever. So it was just a non-issue for me.
Yeah.
I think for some reason the company felt strongly about these 7 or 8 or 9 people that were working in the lab. I don't know why it was such a sensitive thing.
Would they have been concerned that because you had professional qualifications, university degrees, that if you were to unionize, you could? Except that there were, as you were saying, there wasn't much competition jobs in the city.
It really became a non-issue once I started working there. Like, nobody ever talked about it. Just didn't. You would hear about what happened before, quotation marks. But other than that, it was more or less a non-issue.
Was there a strike at any time or a lockout during that time?
There wasn't a lockout, but there was a strike. It was really a very peculiar thing because I'm not going to say it was a big happy family, but people worked closely together. And
up to the manager for whom you have respect.
Everybody. And so they...
So what went awry?
The union decided, you know, well, whatever happened, because I wasn't... I don't know why.
Because you weren't in the local.
So, and I don't think at that point I was on the negotiating committee either. So... I don't know, but I think it probably had a lot to do with pensions, and they decided to go on strike, and it was very strange. I think they were on strike for a little over a week, and we came to work every day and got stopped at the railway tracks, and we were asked to come every day, and we weren't expected to try to cross the picket line.
Well, the manager noted that you had been there, and then you went home.
Yeah, and then I think he said, you know, don't bother coming until it's over.
Mm-hmm.
And we were.
Did they operate during the strike?
No.
No, it was shut down.
Oh no, you can't.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Couldn't possibly.
A few people couldn't staff that kind of operation.
No, it was 24/7. No, there's no way. And so that was the only time they went on strike. They got close to a strike position just before ADM bought Ogilvy.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, the guys were really adamant about their pension and their severance packages.
And it's in the mid-80s that Frank Mazur moves to the the presidency of TCU, isn't it, or the Canadian, I'm not certain what the title was. And Herb,
Herb
was taking over, so that's when you would have been. Seeing her.
Yeah, and it was very tense because the union was not backing down on the severance part of things and mm-hmm. on the pension stuff, and we had mediation, and the mediator was tearing his hair out too because at this point it was Ogilvy, the fellow who was negotiating for Ogilvy. You know, I'm not sure. I don't know. But he was very concerned that as good a bargain as was possible had to be attained without giving away the ranch, because I guess everybody wanted to be in a good position when ADM took over. So the mediator, he was sweating, literally. He says, I can't believe that you're willing to go on strike for a severance package. Anyway, he said that to the company, and I don't know what he said to the
heard the companies.
Yeah, because I was on the company side at that point. I was the company plus the guy from it was me and the fellow from Montreal, and the mediator could not believe. He says, all right, I can't believe this.
Mm-hmm.
You're willing to put these, you know, put these guys out on strike, and so finally, Ogilvy sort of gave in, and you know, it was a good thing too because the guys got just that little bit more when the plant closed, because everybody could see that it was going to happen at some point.
The mediator was basically saying, you know, why is Ogilvy making difficulties when it's going to be someone else?
Pretty much.
Who will shut the place down and who will have to pay the severance?
Yeah.
Of course, they were concerned, as you say, to have Ogilvy anybody be who in was as involved favorable in, position as
in
possible.
Signing on the dotted line, you know, was going to be someone who wanted to be in good favor with ADM, you know. And I mean, I think at this point, that whole closure thing had been hanging over the plant in one form or other for such a long time. And
why do you think ADM did then close it down? I don't know that you said that precisely earlier.
When they closed it?
Yeah, so why would you say they did it?
Why?
What was the final reason?
Money. Money, of course.
There wasn't enough money to be made here?
Yeah, there wasn't. It wasn't. It was a losing operation. Mm. And for all those reasons.
Been run into the ground, you were saying.
Yeah, well, the new process had come in, but it was too little too late. and the effluent, the yields, the cost of transportation, just a whole bunch of things, plus the scale. It was a small plant compared mm-hmm. to the plant in Montreal that was, and you know, the plant in Montreal was closer to its markets, and you yeah. know, just all those reasons, yeah. You know, the same ones.
Did you talk to people from Montreal much these years? You were on the other side, the management side of the table, you were saying, with someone from Montreal. And,
well, I talked to...
How did they regard the plant?
Well, nobody wanted to see it close. You developed good professional relationships, and some of these people became friends, depending on how long you'd been working there, especially the R&D group, because they'd come up here and do their technical stuff, usually with Dryden and Provincial. Mm-hmm. And so... You know, you've had a good relationship, and then there was a relationship among all the Ogilvy plants, period, with the flour mills and the starch plants, so that there was that sort of camaraderie and sort of togetherness. But then...
You mentioned Labatt's ownership, of course. Yes. Do you get a sense of change? Were you close enough to the action to get a sense of the impact that Labatt's ownership of it might have?
Well, it was nice being part of Labatt's... You get a case of blue every July. And,
July 1, I trust.
Yeah. And,
every employee got a case of...
Well, Labatt's. You know, they would do different things for, you know, depending on the year. And at some point, Labatt's was expanding into lots of different food industries. When they bought a mushroom plant, everybody got a little container of mushrooms. And it was nice with Labatt's. And, you know, the Bats wouldn't have sold Ogilvy if they didn't need the cash.
Mm-hmm. So it was actually sort of international finance, or the, as you said, the collapse of the peso in Mexico that forced them to look for cash wherever they could find it.
That's the way I understood it. I mean, it wasn't on the, I mean, I wasn't part of that, but that's what I'd read in the financial papers and stuff, you know, that they sold the jewel in the crown.
Well, that probably, but then there was an attempt to open it again.
Right.
We need to look at that, because you were involved.
I was in charge of it for a little while. The plant closed in 1996, and then I guess there was an outfit in the States called Southern Ventures who had formed this little company called Riverside Grain Products, and they wanted to resurrect this operation. And they were going to, their new attempt was going to focus on reducing the waste stream. Because close to 15% of what went in as expensive flour went out as waste. And
if you could turn that into money, that would be worth a lot.
And, you know, that was another challenge the plant was facing towards the end, was that our emissions of phosphorus were way too high. The city couldn't handle. Because mm-hmm. At that point we were discharging to the city, because we could no longer discharge to the river.
Mm-hmm.
And the city couldn't handle the phosphorus, because they in turn had limits on the amount of phosphorus they could.
Where was the phosphorus?
It's part of the flour. It's a nutrient.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. it was just...
And what were the possibilities? What could you turn phosphorus into?
Oh, well, it was just there. Southern Ventures and Riverside Grain were going to use the starch to put into briquettes, because that's where the secondary starch went. It wasn't worth very much, but a lot of that starch went into making briquettes, because kind of holds the briquette together.
This is like a charcoal fuel.
Yeah. And
and it burns, I suppose, well enough.
Yeah. So that was what they were going to do. So when they were getting ready to actually finalize the purchase of the plant from ADM, they were looking for a manager. And they phoned me, because one of the guys that was working for them used to also work at Ogilvy. You know, so it's because it's that wheat starch world is pretty small. Mm-hmm. And so I had gone back to school to, I was taking some accounting courses and that kind of stuff. And but I went and continued with that on a part-time basis. And then I said I would work for them. So they needed someone who really understood what was in there.
And, which you certainly did.
And so I did a lot of that work for them, you know, told them what they would need and, you know, this sort of stuff. And they were supposed to work on the actual process part of it, because I'm not an engineer. No. I mean, I wish you were, but I'm not.
And they had that expertise, didn't they?
Apparently. And I say apparently because they really didn't.
Mm.
And so I got them what I thought would be organized. I reestablished the relationships with the Ministry of the Environment, the city, all that stuff, whatever it was.
The red tape business people, yeah. Like
and,
the curse.
And ADM wanted us to succeed.
Did they really?
Oh, they did, because they, well, when they, the day they closed, the first closure notice, the mayor at that time, David Hamilton, phoned Andreas, and that was the CEO, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you know, like, what can we do, like, to keep this place, so, you know, the, all that, that, yes. That, you know, that any mayor would do of any town that's losing a major employer like that. And so they wanted this plant to succeed. We were going to be buying our flour from them, and, you know, so they were very cooperative, mm-hmm. Very cooperative with providing information, historical information, all that stuff. And
Were the files still up here in the office? Well, where had that gone?
Well, a lot of it was just destroyed.
It wasn't.
And then a lot of it just went on pallets and went to Kansas, where ADM Milling has their head offices, and they had, I think it went to Russell, Kansas, and they've got these huge warehouses down there where they keep stuff like that. So all the drawings, all that stuff went down there, and then it came back.
It was sent back for this reopening.
Yeah. And so and the Southern Ventures and Riverside Grain Products got the expertise of some starch chemists that used to work for Ogilvy, and, you know, try to introduce a different, another process, another modification process for the starch that I think your Gene Killens would know a lot more about than, mm-hmm. than I would. Because before the plant actually opened, I went and took another position and mm-hmm. at the resin plant.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't involved when in the actual reopening of the plant, but they were far enough along that they could carry on.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, so many people went back to work there that they had their expertise for the process.
Experience, workforce, yes, again.
They did. They yeah. did. And
So how long did you were involved for?
I was involved for probably a little over a year to sort of get them going and to, you know, actually part of that, the purchase. And
and then what happened?
Then Riverside failed. It failed.
How long after you left?
well, I, you know, I'm not sure how long they were actually operating. I think that they might have been operating for a little over a year.
Wasn't your departure that ended up dooming the operation?
No. I think that, well,
they'd be putting money into it for a while, and at some point they need to be.
Well, there's things that probably I really don't want to talk about, but I could see the writing on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I.
Management office failings then?
Just a lack of expertise and money.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, money. Working capital.
Yeah, would be for sure, because pockets. In the end, when you know, I don't know all the ins and outs of how they failed, but certainly money was a big part of it. You know, they couldn't pay their bills, and the processes weren't didn't pan out the way they thought.
Yeah.
And I think if you know, I think that if you wanted to get a sense of that, you should talk to Jean. Because she,
well, we did interview Jean, and I couldn't remember any of the detail from that interview, but you, of course, recommended that we call you, and it took us a while, took me a while to get around to doing that, but I'm glad I did.
She was intimately acquainted with how things were at the plant when it started up, and the things that they had real problems with.
Mm-hmm. And she was there until the end, I guess.
Yes, and she's a great and capable gal, and so.
Well, my sense is that she said the same things about you. So.
Well, did they go into receivership? Who owns the property now?
I think the province owns it. However that works, I read it someplace. They didn't pay their employees. They had creditors in town and elsewhere, and I think the whoever ends up taking it over did. So now it's just a public burden, I think.
In some ways, it sounds similar to the attempt to start Shaw Bakery again the second time, because they ended up failing as well with creditors out there.
Yeah, you know, you just need a pile of money. And, you know, I had written the grant applications for with HRDC, it was at that point, because of the hiring that we were going to
Human Resources Development Canada,
yeah,
yes.
The hiring that we were going to be doing, and, you know, the number of people that were going to be employed, and all the rest of it. So it it was a good project,
yes.
But I think that the substance behind all the ideas just wasn't there.
No.
That's about the as fair yeah. thing as I can say.
The fairest
say.
Thing you can say, right. Well, as I suggested earlier, one of these questions, or maybe it's been more than one, allows us to sort of scan and explore the various stages of work that you've carried out and so on. Then there are a number of questions that are designed to produce nuggets of insight, I suppose,
oh,
or
okay.
memories, such as what would you like the people to know about the work you did in the places that you worked? Well, in this case, it's primarily in this plant. We won't get into the resin plant that you were in for a time, but what would people find interesting about what this plant did over and above all the interesting things you've already told us?
Well, I think that just having something that complex, something beyond raw processing, and having that happen in Thunder Bay, having had the gluten happen in Thunder Bay first in Canada, that was a big deal.
It
was a big deal, and it was a great place to work. I loved it, and I think most people that you talk to liked working there too. And it's one of those things where it was at a time and place where it was the good old days, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
and I guess that's what I recall, that we produced something of value.
Good old days in what sense, as against what's happened since?
Well, it was I guess we weren't as aware of how the rest of the world can intrude on your life and change things. When Ogilvy closed, I think there were only maybe a couple of other outfits in town that had closed, and mm-hmm. now it's a
the good old days of an industrial age.
Yes, yeah,
okay.
that's what I'm talking
right.
about.
Yes.
Yeah, life was good.
Yes.
Life was good. I was hoping to retire there,
mm-hmm.
because so many people did retire there, and it that idea of having, you know, one employer, and you know, you work with people and you get to know them and know their families, and that was important.
Let's keep the change theme. There's a later question, so I won't press it now. What might interest or surprise people most about the work that you did? You may have already suggested that in a sense, the sheer fact of
that it happened in Thunder Bay and most people didn't know. Unless you lived in Fort William, people just didn't.
Hardly even aware that it was there, and that sort of stuff was going on there. And that one of the products was feeding shrimp for you to enjoy in Thailand, or that the
gypsum wallboard that you bought had starch that was produced in Thunder Bay.
Back in the '60s, when I was truck driving for Redicup Lumber in the early '60s, a good deal of GLA, gypsum lime alabastine wallboard, was on the back of the truck I would drive. And I guess it may have been sizing from here then, the starch that was part of the process of making those
sheets. One of the products I didn't talk about was, it's a sort of a meat extender binder. It's a mixture of gluten and flour. And that stuff is sort of still used in some sausages and things, you know. So for me, it was a big awakening as far as the food industry goes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what's involved in food.
Yeah, the industrialization of our diet. There are whole books on that subject by now.
We were producing basically natural ingredients.
Yes.
We had kosher certification for our food products.
What kind of certification?
Kosher.
Oh, kosher. I see.
Could you have gone organic?
Unless we used organic wheat.
Yes.
It's
a niche.
Yeah. No, it was... No, it wasn't. It wasn't organic, and it wouldn't have been. I don't think, because I don't think.
You were just buying first class prairie wheat. So who's going to? What could be higher than that?
Organic.
So.
No fertilizers or sprays. The spraying I did as a kid on the farm. Mm-hmm. What are you most proud of in the work that you did at IGP?
Well, personally, it was, you know, the relationships, the integrity, because we were making food, and some of it was destined for, some of our products also we tested for USP, for pharmaceuticals, and so I was proud of that, and everybody that worked there could and did take pride in what we made.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the work you did contributed to Canada's success as an international grain trader? probably not all. Well, in terms of the product and its
global.
Well,
we still have a gluten plant in Canada.
Yeah.
And the reason the gluten is as good as it is because of the flour.
Mm-hmm.
And
the quality of the grain.
It's you can't have one without the other.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly knew whenever they made a budget purchase of flour, it showed in the process.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell that dough wasn't the same.
Mm-hmm.
It was more waste. It was sloppy. Yeah.
And that did happen. They didn't always get number one northern or whatever best grain. The flour is based on that kind of grain.
Sometimes they, you know, would slip in and try to use these lower grade flours at a reduced rate, you know.
Yeah.
And you could tell.
Mm-hmm.
The operators could tell, certainly.
Yes.
You know, there'd be differences.
The big balls wouldn't be very good.
Well, the gluten wasn't as good.
Yeah.
It was sloppier.
More expensive to produce, I guess, at the end of the day.
Those were financial decisions, and so they decided that at a certain percentage for certain, if they got a deal, because that stuff wasn't always available either, right? And so, or they would try a different kind of wheat, Glenlee wheat. Have you heard of Glenlee wheat?
It's a difference.
It's an off-board wheat. It was, I guess there is. Okay, good. There's no weak board anymore, but it was off board.
Right.
So
I have heard of it.
And it didn't process as well, no. But used it a little bit at a time, then you could, you know, our measurements weren't sophisticated enough to really figure out how much we'd wasted and thrown mm-hmm. down the drain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there are obviously disconnections between your work and the work of farmers growing the grain handled in the grain drain. I don't know whether to specify those further. Actually, I think would you want to add anything to what you were just saying, actually, about Glenlee wheat, a lower quality of wheat, as it seemed, in terms of the...
Well, we did use...
As against the others, which were coming through the
wheat
board from the farmers.
The best wheats made the best flour, made the best gluten. I think that's how it worked.
Yes, I can well imagine. Well, that's why I'm wondering whether what seems a bargain when you're purchasing it as an ingredient...
Well, I think it...
Does it end up being a good... seller at the end, you make money to match what you think you've saved.
Yeah, as I said, I don't think we were sophisticated enough in our measurements, our ability to measure how much we actually wasted. Because we, you know, a huge part of the operation actually was the treatment of the effluent. At one point, all the effluent just went into the Cam River. And then I think then the ministry issued a control order. I guess that was in the late 70s. And then I think in 1979...
Soon after you started, then.
Yeah, there was an anaerobic waste digestion facility built there, and that worked really well for a while. But then the province no longer wanted industry discharging directly into waterways. They wanted to go through municipal.
Mm-hmm. Processing plants, treatment plants.
So that, and the city was very cooperative with that, except that they could not handle the phosphorus because mm-hmm. that impinged on them, because I mean our phosphorus was high, and so that ended up being a real big problem in the end too.
And phosphorus releases are infamous, aren't they?
Well,
dying of Lake Erie because of the combination of presumably detergent,
well, it's such a nutrient,
runoff, and so on. So yes, it is such a nutrient.
It's such a nutrient that you have all kinds of other stuff going on. And there was one particular parameter, the BOD5, the biological mm-hmm. oxygen demand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was a huge thing for us.
It would be.
And
was there any possibility of its being turned into fertilizer?
Well, I think that that was looked at when that was looked at, and I can't remember. I think it was tried somehow. It wasn't successful and not pursued.
Because you wouldn't have just phosphorus in the fertilizer, so that may have been the problem, getting the others, the nitrogen.
When ADM was looking at the feasibility of having an ethanol plant attached to the mm-hmm. wheat starch and gluten, I think there was a feed and fertilizer aspect of it, but you know mm-hmm. it never happened. So.
Yeah. Did the plant require subsidization? You mentioned the startup again, HRDC monies for people, but in the earlier operation, I don't suppose there was much in the way of government subsidies at all.
No, I don't think so.
No.
I don't know, but I don't think so. I don't ever, in the time I was there, I don't remember. I think the biggest subsidy we got was when I was able to hire a summer student in the lab.
You did mention, of course, the Western Grain Transportation Act, the loss
subsidy
to grain movement for everyone.
Yeah, yes. So that was a huge subsidy, I guess.
And in the early 80s, the last Trudeau ministry, or the last Pierre Trudeau ministry, was really concerned about the potential demands of the Crow's Pass Agreement. There's a whole book about the end of the Crow, or the work towards that.
It was a huge deal at the time, if I recall. And but you know, it makes sense. The grain generally, a lot of it's going the other way. It should be cleaned on the prairies. Why should it come here to get cleaned? Mm. There's all those things, sadly.
Yeah.
You know.
And how much of the grain could be fed to animals on the prairie so they never had to be moved, and so on and so forth. There's all kinds of debates to be carried on. Well, you saw all kinds of major changes on the job over the years, I'm sure. Would you want to think in terms of changes?
Well, we had a major process change, and before I had come, of course, there had been process changes because they started in 1943 and then obviously done a few things by the time I got there. And that was interesting. It was sort of a dynamic environment and really nice to work in that. And it was nice to see the money being invested in the plant, and, you know, that was good. And then there was there were changes in just the way plants are managed, people are managed.
And the people who are
organizational change, that sort of stuff. I was always interested in that.
Yeah.
And
well, you mentioned your own role in the non-traditional employees.
And then, you know,
women coming into the...
You know, and then working to improve quality, reduce rejections, getting people to work together, you know, the production workers and the maintenance workers and the lab to mm-hmm. for some of these quality issues, not just production issues, but quality issues. And that was exciting. I've enjoyed organizational change mm-hmm. through my career. It's interesting, and
someone who enjoys that is a natural born manager, I suppose.
Well, I like working with people.
Yes.
And actually working with people, mm-hmm. and it always appealed to me. And I...
As one of the pioneers of women in an industrial setting as an employee, how was that? Did you find it easy?
There was a... I didn't find it too difficult. Because when I started working there, I was married. So that made it a whole lot easier for the guys, because I was married.
Yeah.
The other girl wasn't. And so there was, you know, a little bit of those guy-girl things.
Yeah.
That.
Were there many single men in the plant?
There were. But, you know, it just became a non-issue pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like people were afraid of, what are we going to do? It's going to have this one girl in the lab with all those men in the plant all night. Yeah, well, you know what? Everybody's busy. They're working.
Yeah. Jolly well should be.
They're working. And what my personal feeling on men and women working together is that it keeps everybody on their best behavior.
It improves the quality of the workplace.
I think it does. I think it does. And I really I appreciated the chance to do that. Mm-hmm. When I was looking for jobs in the first place, this is in town here, I had people come right out and tell me I had the wrong plumbing. Back in the days when they could do that.
Yeah.
They might think it now, but back then they could actually tell you.
You had plastic instead of copper?
There was a move to encourage women to move into non-traditional employment. Was your hiring at IGP influenced by that? Because that was happening in the late 70s, wasn't it? Some of our grain inspectors were coming in thanks to a federal program.
I think that at the time that I got hired, they needed someone. I had applied that day, and the manager was a great guy. the lab manager, and I just got really lucky. I got lucky. I was there at the right time, and
your skills were needed, and there you were.
Yeah, and I worked in a lab before, you know, because I worked at the Grain Commission.
Sure.
And
the industry.
Yeah, at least you know knew what a protein test was and knew what some of this stuff was, and so.
Would you want to expand on the good old days and what we were beginning to open up there? The fact that there was a lakehead, an industrial lakehead in those years. through into the 90s, but from the 90s onwards, there's been an incredible amount of deindustrialization, and not just in the actual making of things. When I think of the grain handlers, if there were 1,800 of them, as Frank Missouri was telling me around in 1984 when I was first elected.
Well, my dad worked for Sask Pool, and you know, the grain trade, in one way or another, everybody, if your father wasn't working there, then maybe your uncle was, or somebody down the street, or it was just part of life here, and it was it was exciting. They were, you know, they're magnificent structures.
Remember those when elevators? Oh yes.
I remember when I was in high school, I was part of a student exchange to Quebec, and when we came back here with our partners, one of the things that had been organized was a visit to a grain elevator, and they took us to the top, and it's extraordinary, the view from the top, and. You know, and then the seaway and all the boats that used to be here and where they were from. You know, my dad used to come home from work and, you know, say that he'd been, you know, talking to someone, we're Polish, and, you know, he'd been talking to someone from Poland, and you know, there was also some Russian people there, and, you know, whatever. And it was just exciting. And I think that, I guess, the point of all of that is that when you've got that sort of thing going on, there's a lot of pride to be had from producing something of value.
There is.
And you're making something tangible, and it is more valuable than when it started.
Yeah, that's and right. You have added value too.
And the skills and the trades and all that goes into that, it's a great experience, and we don't have that. And, like, we've got the mill, we've got Bombardier.
Mill.
Yeah, we've got one paper mill.
Yes.
And, you know, people used to be able to have a life. You know, you used to be able to raise a family, do all that stuff, if you were just a regular person.
Yes.
A regular person could do
that. A high school grad, or even conceivably less.
And you could build your skills and and move ahead. But the opportunities for doing that now are just, they're different. I imagine they're still there. Yeah. After I actually got really excited the other day when I was looking at, they had on TV, they were talking about the cyclotron, and they had the process there. And I thought, there's a process in Thunder Bay. How exciting is that?
Yes.
You know, you know,
heard a presentation about the cyclotron, and
it is
exciting to have these things happen, but that's a very small operation. I don't know how many people are employed.
Yeah, I don't know, but they're making something of value.
Yes, they are indeed. Isotopes that are life-preserving or life-assisting.
You know, and I think that if a country isn't producing things of value besides services, then it's not a good sign for me. To be able to feed yourself, provide your country with, to do those things yourself, as opposed to not. I think that.
Well, if you end up having to buy them from elsewhere and you don't have anything to sell, and your trade is going to go badly into imbalance.
And then when someone else wants it,
yes,
and they're not going to give it to you.
Yes.
You know, I don't know. It's.
One wonders about the challenge. The next couple of questions are about challenges other than change. But I wonder to what extent it becomes a combination of management and financial challenges, mistakes made or whatever. In the case of Labatt's, I suppose for them to be expanding in a large way in Mexico, in a country where they might have checked with the international financial people to see whether this was a bright idea at that time. But to what extent is it a capitalist failure that produced this end result in Thunder Bay?
Well, I think that it's part of what, I mean, I'm not quite sure what you call it, but I've read a little bit lately and heard a little bit lately about the sort of the lack of innovation in Canada and that lack We're just different. Like, we're not like, we're not Americans. You know, they'll go out and they're going to make it happen. And I think that if there were a bit more of that in Canada for, you know, it's not even so, it's a little bit of the risk taking and a little bit of just going out and doing those things rather than being as laid back as we sometimes are.
Yeah.
I think that some of these things would have, you know, that we would be doing more. But I don't know if that's true or not.
Oh, no. Oh. Well, in that case, we better not talk about Nortel, BlackBerry, and Bombardier. I think that we don't have the time for that on the tape. Okay. Well, maybe I'll slide past the challenge questions, major challenges the industry faced. You, I think, already focused a number of those in terms of the into the grain movement and so on and so forth. What are your most vivid memories about the job? These are the ultimate nugget possibilities.
The people, and I think that's probably true of most jobs, is you remember the people that you worked with, and you know, some of our successes when things worked out. And I started out green, and by the time I left, I had done a lot of my professional and personal growing there, and so three part of my life I was there for 19 years.
If I were to ask whether you have something, if you had to brag about something, what would be the ultimate bragging about those 19 years and what you achieved or what you became, perhaps?
Well, I was really really glad to have an opportunity.
You started as a kind of a chemist.
Yeah,
became much more than that.
Yes, and I was really just glad to have the opportunity to do that. You know, I lucked out getting the job in the first place, had a manager who didn't care what kind of plumbing you had.
Yeah.
And so it was just great for me. And I think I provided in the lab an environment that... you know, that allowed people there to grow too.
Mm-hmm.
People came and they left, and when they left for something better, everyone was happy for them. It was a great proving ground.
On the job training in more ways than one.
Right,
a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Yes. Do you think it's a good idea for us to be interviewing you today and preserving the history of the grain trade?
If you'd asked me 20 years ago, I might have had a different answer. But now I think it's really important to hear people's personal histories and how that fits into things. I find myself reading things now where it's really about people in the context of what's happening around them, because it is history, right?
Yes. Are you retired now completely?
I am retired, but not completely. I finished my career as an accountant, if you can believe that. And
that is a long way from
and I can,
the chemistry class.
And I can tell you that I did not miss my calling. I was good at it, and
what,
I had and
which
I got
qualification did you achieve?
Well, I was working on my CGA and then decided that my husband was already retired, and I was at that age, and I thought I can have this designation in a couple of years, but I'm not going to be any happier than I am right now. And I had buried a few friends, and I thought, no, I am retired. So I work a couple of years during the personal tax season, and I love it, but processing in that environment, that was my milieu. And
that's where you lived, eh?
And I didn't know it when I started, but I was very lucky that I had a chance to do that in Thunder Bay, because I don't think people would have that chance now.
No.
And it's too bad.
Outside, I guess, the healthcare system.
If you're outside the healthcare system, you know, if you can luck out into something at the paper mill or at Bombardier or whatever, but just generally for and that skill, that is leaving Thunder Bay. It's not there. Yeah. It's not in the collective consciousness.
No.
I have a friend at the economic development
corporation.
And that skill set that you know, if you wanted, needed people to work in a plant.